I would like to present Alan Brody, who is Professor of Theater and Associate Provost for the Arts at Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Alan Brody.
Before you ask, yes, we do have the arts at MIT. I tell you, after this morning, I don't know what I'm going to do. That was just such a fabulous morning. But now we're going to talk about theater. I have to tell you, we did a production of QED at MIT. Wonderful Boston actor by the name of Jeremiah Kissel did it, and John Lipsky directed it. It's a terrific play, just a wonderful play. And there's a moment that comes later in the play from what David read so gorgeously, which to me was so perfect to talk about the scientist. He's on the phone with his doctor, and the doctor is giving him odds on the operation, and they're not good. And he said he has to make a decision about whether to go through with the operation or not. Finally, he decides to do it, and he says, just do one thing for me. He says, if I'm dying, wake me up. I want to know what it's like. It's a wonderful moment. I think the thing that was so amazing about this morning, for me, knowing you don't know what I'm going to say, I do. So I was hearing what was going on from my point of view, and you started talking about religion. We're going to talk about that in my paper, but bear with me, okay, with that, because it's somewhat, I'm trying to work out a somewhat complicated, I think, idea about that. And also, I had an illumination because Marcia was talking about the feeling in the air that something is going on and is about to break. And I think that's another reason we're having conferences like this now, where the arts and science are somehow coming together and trying to, that science is becoming a part of the arts. You know, it'll happen in this paper, I think. Describe it. For the past 2 years or so, and I think Alan and I are going to talk about this a little later too, we've been having these monthly informal wine and cheese get-togethers at MIT between playwrights and scientists. It's been absolutely incredible. We discuss the points of contact between the processes of the scientist and the theater artist, the criteria for success in our different disciplines, questions of ethics, you know, all the stuff, you know, that's been sort of in the air here. We share stories, insights. It's I call it a convivial anti-CP Snow guerrilla group. One of the moments in this session stands out for me in relation to what I'm going to talk about today. Bob Jaffe, whom many of you may know, a theoretical physicist, who had just joined the group, said, well, why are there so many plays about science nowadays? And I said, because theater's always been about religion. And science is the religion of our time. Bob's face told me that that needed a little explaining. So I'm going to do that now. I am not talking about any kind of organized religion that always demands faith in the contemporary world. I'm talking about those things that we believe in so irrefutably that we don't even have to think about them. Those things that are the basis from which all our other realistic decisions are made, and the comfort we take from the idea that the world has some kind of coherence. Not meaning, not purpose, just coherence, okay? I'm talking about principles that describe our universe, organize our lives, and make sense of the world we inhabit. I'm talking about absolute belief. In the medieval period, the existence of God was not a question of faith. It was a matter of fact, simply the way things were, and everything followed from that. You didn't need faith when you knew from the evidence of your eyes that the earth was the center of God's universe. You didn't question the ordering principle of God. God was the way things are. Now, there could be debates about the nature of God, about how God works, God's attributes, God's laws, but not about whether God was the ordering principle until Copernicus and Galileo, and then Newton. If you think about it, you can argue about the nature of science, how science works, science's attributes, science's laws, but not about science. Okay. And in fact, it wasn't until Copernicus and Galileo, and that, well, slightly before him, certainly, that they started burning people up for thinking differently. Today, whether we have faith in God or not, it's science that tells us the way things are. All right, let's set aside all the political controversy about evolution and creationism. I'd suggest that whichever side someone is on in that struggle, if you were to ask them if they believe in science, they would say yes without question. And in fact, the argument the creationists use against evolution is a scientific argument. It's flawed, but it's in the language of science. So it's those unquestioned assumptions about the way things are, the order of the universe that we take for granted, that gives existence collective shape and meaning, and that's what I call the religion of the time, and this is science in the 21st century. And theater has mirrored contemporary assumptions about the cosmos throughout its history. It's what theater does. See, everything this morning worked. It's what Shakespeare called holding up the mirror to nature, right? And that's what it does. Holds up the mirror to nature and defines it. In Greece, now we're going to roller skate through history. In Greece, even after they had anthropomorphized the powers of nature and called them gods, the performance space itself incorporated the organization of the cosmos. I'm going to talk about structure here, and architectural structure as much as dramatic structure. You have a raised platform that placed the principals between the chorus and the sky, and they're flanked by statues of the gods. The hero's body is the battleground of the gods, and the chorus witnesses the revelation of truth as the action plays out before them. And the audience, with the Aegean Sea in view behind the Scaena, witnesses it as well. They're awestruck and they're celebrating the way things are. Okay. Now, I'm stressing the configuration of the playing space here, because it was this that also determined the structure of the performance itself, how the story was told. Could trace the ways in which this idea that theater architecture itself embodies the cosmos of its time through history. The way the medieval theater originates in a church structure that mirrors the organization of the Christian cosmos, as every church does. And how anachronisms abound in the narrative, because all time is one in the mind of God. And you can have a multiplicity of playing spaces reflecting how all creation is one in the mind of God. And then the Elizabethan theater comes along with its painted zodiac over the thrust stage and very real throne. Okay? And it reflects the ways in which God's will is now manifested in his kings, and how the structure and content of the theater becomes wholly secularized, and the king is the effective ordering principle of society. And then the theater moves indoors as the problematic tension between faith and reason, church and state, begins to escalate. And when Galileo and Newton's demonstration of a mathematically measured and proven organization of the universe takes hold as irrefutable, time in the drama becomes linear, and perspective in scenery becomes the norm. I'm talking about Galileo and Newton not only because they revolutionized science, but because they ultimately changed the very nature of the common sky under which we live in the West. From the 18th century on, the theater continues indoors. The basic shape of the audience, the auditorium, with its objective relationship between audience and performers, embodies the new objective principle of science. Dramatic action has linear structure. The playing space is circumscribed by a proscenium arch so that we can view it. And by the early 20th century, the structure and content of theater has become entirely secularized. The influence of Freud and Marx's worldview is reflected in psychological realism, expressionism, epic theater. For a while, Freud and Marx become powerful sects of the contemporary scientific religion, maybe, but neither gains the full power or endurance that pure scientific thought has. Science and the processes of reason and verifiable result have already become the foundations of communal belief transcending sectarianism. The well-made play reflects the well-made cosmos. And along comes Einstein and Heisenberg and quantum physics. And they redefine the nature of time and space and what happens in the theater. Well, first, their ideas reshape the common cosmos. The shape of the theater fractures. New forms of storytelling become possible because we are seeing nature with new eyes. The curtain that delineated the realms of objective audience and examined performance disappears. The stage becomes round, square, three-quarters, site-specific. Time becomes circular, simultaneous, capable of moving forward and back. Space and light take on new and more variable characteristics. The very action of the drama becomes more ambiguous and, in certain ways, more precise. We're moving into the age of postmodernism, and it's a direct, clear child of quantum physics. The audience responds to these shifts because they know they embody the scientific truth of the way things are. And so the theater is still mirroring that. And slow down, Alan. Okay, I want to look at some contemporary plays about science or scientists that embody the religion of the time and how some of them are having an effect on the structure of the drama in general. Ever since really starting with Arcadia, the kind of delight that ensued as Tom Stoppard showed off the way he did, that he could structure a play on mathematics and chaos theory. Science and mathematics appear fairly regularly on serious stages. It's happening more and more clearly. In most plays, some aspect of science or mathematics serves as a plot device. In others, it structures the piece. And in a few, the performance actually embodies some scientific principle. The central character in David Auburn's play, Proof. How many of you know Proof? Oh, good. Okay, terrific. Have you talked about it before? Because I came in like, oh, good. The action of the play traces a woman's attempt to break free of the fear that she's going to lose her mind as her father did in his last few years. The woman and her dead father are both brilliant mathematicians. Okay. The father appears in fantasy sequences and flashback memories. The major event of the play is the revelation that she had found a proof that a father had been working on before he lost his abilities. And critics and audiences, you know, remarked on the originality of the play because it incorporated mathematics into its plot. And they saw it as a trend toward plays about science. Proof is not really about mathematics at all. It's a traditional psychological drama. Okay. The mathematical proof is an engine that drives the action only insofar as it serves to free the female character. The mathematical proof is finally no different structurally than Big Daddy's inheritance in Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, or George and Martha's son in Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. And Cat on a Hot Tin Roof is not about inheritance law. And Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf sure as hell isn't about parenting. The closest we get to witnessing the mathematical process in proof is this beautifully crafted scene where the father believes he's found a brilliant new proof, and it turns out it's a manic delusion. I mean, it's just a spine-chilling scene, wonderful coup de théâtre, and it's still not about mathematics. But the success of the play suggested there's a new interest in the way that the subjects of mathematics and science were becoming a conscious part of the subject matter of plays that were already unconsciously structured on early 19th and 20th century scientific principles. Michael Frayn's Copenhagen, on the other hand, uses Heisenberg's uncertainty principle as well as nuclear physics to inform the very structure of the drama. And this moves closer to a new form. It's not there yet, but it moves closer, where the subject and the structure begin to inform each other. You know the play. I'm not going to we've been talking about it a lot, but the three characters, Heisenberg, Bohr, and Bohr's wife, Margaret, are in an undetermined space and time. Each remembers the events of the visit differently. Each assigns it his or her own significance. By the end of the play, we've witnessed the entire meeting in Copenhagen from three different perspectives, but the truth of any one of them is left unresolved. And the dramatization, here's the real thing, the dramatization of the single elusive event, which is already in the past of the characters and being examined from the dramatic present of the action, embodies the principle of uncertainty. So it's actually informing the structure itself that way. So the principle is not only one of the themes in the play, it's the source of its dramatic structure. And that's very different, obviously, from proof. In 2001, the Piccolo Teatro in Milan offered an entire play, a season of plays, dealing with science. Incredible. They included, unfortunately, they were all in Italian. They included Copenhagen, Brecht's Galileo, which we haven't talked about much here, a new play about Giordano Bruno, and one extraordinary theatrical event called Infinities. It's not to be confused with my play, Small Infinities. Infinities represents perhaps the most sophisticated and revelatory incorporation of science into a theatrical event today, and I believe it may point to a whole new direction in the relationship between science and theater. It just blew me away. Franco Ronconi directed it. He's the artistic director of the Piccolo. He was planning the season of plays about science, and he approached John Barrow from Cambridge. Many of you may know John, know Barrow. He asked him to write something for the season. And Barrow said he wasn't a playwright. And Ronconi explained that that's why he asked him. He didn't want a play, he wanted a scientific paper. And he asked Barrow to write a paper about some aspect of infinity. and said he would theatricalize the text. Okay? That's exactly what happened. He wrote a paper on five paradoxes of infinity. Ronconi rented an empty warehouse for the piccolo and proceeded to divide it into five playing areas. He found ways to embody each of the five paradoxes through the manipulation of the performers' bodies in carefully designed spaces. The physical actions within each space lasted from about 15 to 20 minutes and then repeated in a kind of loop. The audience was free to move from one space to another in any pattern they wanted, including constantly returning to one or another of them. Okay. The only language came from the barrow paper, whether in the mouths of the performers or in a voice over the action, and it was breathtaking. And what started to happen, you see, was that you really began to feel, to witness the these paradoxes of infinity, but to begin to feel yourself physically engaged with them in some way. It was the sensation of Milan that year. But it's not strictly a play, okay? It's a theatrical event. None of the familiar dramatic material of conflict between characters, no Aristotelian beginning, middle, and end. And in speaking about it after it had opened, Ronconi was very explicit about this. He said he appreciated the narrative structures of the Brecht play, and Copenhagen, and even the somewhat sprawling Giordano Bruno play, but he was searching for a new theatrical form that would accommodate the new world view and the subject of science. He didn't want infinities to be about science. He wanted it to be embodied science. It was the most radical meeting of science and theater I've seen to date. And like most radical ventures, it threw new light on the more centrist work. The most marked aspect of Infinities is its absolute lack of narrative. It freed it from any trace of linearity and points to ways the theater may someday tackle string theory or imaginings of new dimensions. Yeah? Proof and Copenhagen are good plays in their own rights, but a work like Infinity helps make us aware of how they depend on earlier conventions, structures that rest on a vision really of the Newtonian cosmos. They trace their lineage in plays about science to Ibsen's An Enemy of the People, which uses a scientific issue to explore political and social conflict. Shaw's Back to Methuselah, which really tried to dramatize and extend Darwin. Brecht's Galileo, which explores the ethical responsibilities of the scientist through biographical epic. All use narrative and character as their armatures. Infinity's lineage lies in Samuel Beckett, who is really the inheritor of the quantum world. In the cyclic movement of Waiting for Godot, with its apparent non-events. In Crap's Last Tape, with its revelation of the past and the present. And in Endgame, with its vision of entropy and infinite time that is made palpable for the audience in the final elongated and agonizing moments. Any of you have ever seen a good production of Endgame, you have that experience of just falling into the vision of that play. In Beckett's work, we experience the world as it is described by the new science, even though there's no direct allusion to science at all. As a mid-20th century theatrical event, it was prophetic for some, was baffling for a lot of people, but it was one of the first major articulations of what it was like to be alive in the mid-20th century in a world of science. And after E equals MC squared became part of the common vocabulary. In fact, Hallie Flanagan, who started a living newspaper in the 1930s, did one last play of the living newspaper in the early 1950s, and guess what it was called? E equals MC squared. I want to talk about one other play, a theater event, and that's Robert Lepage's Far Side of the Moon, which he's now been touring. It's a one-man show, one man and 500 stagehands. But it's halfway, in certain ways, it's halfway between Copenhagen and Infinities in its structure. Lepage is known, he's an artist, a theater artist that works out of Montreal. He's been really quite extraordinary. He's known for his multimedia productions, some of them lasting up to 6 or 7 hours. Talk about Infinity. He does take characters through some kind of journey, and the narrative is interspersed with startling poetic stage imagery, film, and technological spectacle. And it's anything but linear. And the weight between the story and sustained, physically engaging imagery is always in this delicate balance. And it kind of, it seems to me that, that his work absolutely mirrors the place we're at now in terms of the shift in the common mind, in the theater audience's mind, in the nature of the scientific cosmos that we the cosmos that we live in as we understand it from science. It ostensibly tells the story of two estranged brothers, and they're both played by a single actor in the production. The relationship is strained by the recent death of their mother. The real focus, though, is on one of the brothers, Philippe, an unsuccessful historian of science. He keeps being late for conferences. Who traces his own development through the history of all things, the Russian space program. And he's becoming more and more fascinated with the world beyond the moon, beyond our own cosmos in the play. And early in the play, it lasts about 2 hours and 10 minutes, no intermission. But they tell you that beforehand, so you can. And the audience is introduced to the temporally and spatially fractured shape of the journey. The major character is emptying his laundry from a washing machine. And he's finished, he puts his head through the door and then his shoulders. And his whole body disappears through the washing machine door as we see a video of him from the other side seeming to enter space. That image transforms into a Russian astronaut weightless leaving his ship to begin a spacewalk. Okay. And the bleeding of one of those images into the other is simply breathtaking. The ideas of space and space travel, the possibilities of extragalactic life, as well as historical footage of the Russian space program, run through all of the imagery of Far Side of the Moon. It's the final image of the play, when the dual threads of traditional narrative and the postmodern images come together, absolutely breathtaking stage conceit. Philippe is sitting in one line of chairs arranged horizontally on the stage, and behind and slightly above him, tilted, is a mirror that runs along the length of the stage, okay? And the floor is black. And he drops off the chair and begins to move around on the floor, on his stomach, on his back. He occasionally grasps a chair, but he's moving freely over this black floor. And in the mirror, as we watch him, he is floating weightless. And it's sustained for a good 5 minutes, which is very long for stage time, and the audience finds itself experiencing weightlessness. Now, even while we're aware of how the illusion is being made, and that's what's so marvelous about it. We can go back and forth, you see, and see, watch him writhing around on the floor, and then all we have to do is look up, and we're there, you know, and we're weightless. like Infinities, he creates moments that are not about their subject, but embody the subject. At the same time, he does develop individual characters whose lives are directly influenced by the scientific world they inhabit. You know, those are just a few of the ways in which science, as the organizing principle of knowledge in the world, is gaining density in the fabric of contemporary theater. It's informing the theater artist's vision of the nature Hamlet wants to mirror. The plays that are the products of the Newtonian worldview will, of course, continue to have something to say to us when they touch on universal human experience, just as those of the Greeks and the medieval mystery plays and Shakespeare do. But as contemporary science redefines the cosmos, that new definition will gradually become absorbed into the consciousness and belief system of the populace. And when it becomes an undisputed truth, the theater will reflect it, not just as subject, but in the very structure of its dramas and their production. Thank you.